Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. The law firms that appeased Trump and angered their clients. After firms struck deals to avoid punitive executive orders, some big clients decided to take their business elsewhere. By Aaron Mulvaney, Emily Glazer, C. Ryan Barber, and Josh Dawsey. At a recent luncheon at Cipriani in Midtown Manhattan, a top lawyer for Citadel delivered a message to leaders of some of the country's biggest law firms. Brooke Cuccinelli told them that the hedge fund company likes to work with law firms that aren't afraid of a fight. Cuccinelli, head of litigation and regulatory inquiries at the business headed by Republican mega donor Ken Griffin, made no mention of politics, but some of the lawyers in attendance took her remarks as reference to a controversy that has been roiling the legal industry. Some of the listed attendees worked for firms that had cut deals with the White House to avoid punitive executive orders by President Trump. Others were at law firms that had gone to court to fight them. Support for the law firms that didn't make deals has been growing inside the offices of corporate executives. At least 11 big companies are moving work away from law firms that settled with the administration or are giving or intend to give more business to firms that have been targeted but refused to strike deals, according to general counsels at those companies and other people familiar with those decisions. Among them are technology giant Oracle, investment bank Morgan Stanley, an airline, and a pharmaceutical company. Microsoft expressed reservations about working with a firm that struck a deal, and another such firm stopped representing McDonald's in a case a few months before a scheduled trial. In interviews, general counsels expressed concern about whether they could trust law firms that struck deals to fight for them in court and in negotiating big deals if they weren't willing to stand up for themselves against Trump. The general counsel of a manufacturer of medical supplies said that if firms facing White House pressure don't have a hard line, they don't have any line at all. Since late February, Trump has issued a half dozen executive orders that direct agencies to remove law firms' security clearances, limit access to federal buildings, and remove their clients' government contracts, citing connections between those firms and the president's enemies. Trump has said many law firms have weaponized the legal system to hamper the work of the administration. Four firms, Jenner & Block, Perkins Coie, Wilmer Hale, and Sussman Godfrey, elected to fight the administration in court. The leaders of other firms thought such litigation would destabilize their businesses and send clients running for the exits. In March, one of those firms, Paul Weiss, surprised the industry by reaching a deal with the White House to rescind the order in exchange for providing pro bono work for causes supported by the administration. Eight other firms, including Kirkland & Ellis, Skadden, Simpson, Thatcher, A&O, Sherman, and Latham & Watkins, reached pacts. In total, the capitulating firms, which include some of the industry's largest and best known, agreed to provide about $1 billion in pro bono work. The agreements were supposed to buy peace and allow the firms to move on, but in the weeks since, they have caused rifts between partners, alienated some younger associates, and created problems with some longtime clients. Lost trust. Leaders of the firms that struck deals with the White House said they did so in part to protect their clients, who were at risk of losing their government contracts as a result of the White House's executive orders against the law firms. Not long after Latham struck a deal in April, the firm's chair, Richard Trobman, met with Morgan Stanley's chief legal officer, Eric Grossman. People familiar with the meeting said Grossman heard him out about the firm's reasoning for striking a deal and acknowledged that companies have to do what is best for themselves. Soon after that meeting, Grossman and other Morgan Stanley lawyers communicated to law firms targeted by the White House that hadn't signed deals that they were looking to give them new business, the people familiar with the meeting said. Paul Weiss, a 1,200 lawyer firm that works on many big corporate deals, was one of the first law firms targeted by a Trump executive order. The general counsel of one major financial firm said her anxiety grew by the day when Paul Weiss didn't sue quickly after being hit with the order. When she heard the firm struck a deal with the White House, she said she felt physically ill. A top legal executive at another company said she called partners at Paul Weiss before it cut its deal to reassure the firm she would remain loyal, even though doing so risked millions in government contracts. She was shocked when the firm chair, Brad Karp, announced a deal, she said, after her company had plans to move work away from Paul Weiss. The day after Paul Weiss struck its deal, female general counsels gathered for a conference in Washington. During a panel at the Women's General Counsel Network event, a lawyer stood up and said her company had taken steps that morning to pull its business from Paul Weiss. The lawyer received thunderous applause. About 2 weeks later, McDonald's told a court that star Paul Weiss lawyer Loretta Lynch was withdrawing its attorney in a high-profile lawsuit accusing the fast food giant of discrimination against black-owned media companies. Lynch, who had served as attorney general under former President Barack Obama, had been involved with the case for several years. It is unusual for companies to shake up representation close to trial. Karp, Paul Weiss's chair and a longtime Democratic donor, had said he made a difficult choice that was necessary to save the firm. In an internal memo, he called the chief executive order an existential crisis, saying the firm risked losing partners and clients if it sued to block the order. He has told others that handling the executive order was more difficult than managing the firm through the coronavirus pandemic. Firms that struck deals hoped to find solidarity in numbers. The country's largest firm, Kirkland & Ellis, which had about $9 billion in revenue last year, lobbied its peers to sign deals. Trump and the law firms have only disclosed limited details about what pro bono work they have agreed to undertake for the administration. General counsel said that makes it hard for companies to know where conflicts of interest might arise. Trump has taken an expansive view about what is required, openly musing about enlisting the firms to help negotiate trade deals or revive the coal industry. In April, the general counsel of Microsoft, John Palmer, discussed with leaders of Latham his concerns about the deal the firm had struck, including how it could affect Latham's ability to represent Microsoft, especially before the government, according to people familiar with the discussion. On April 17th, Microsoft put its concerns in writing, removing Latham from a list of about a dozen preferred firms that it has vetted to handle outside legal work, according to a document described to the journal. About 2 weeks later, after a series of conversations with Latham's leaders that addressed concerns about potential conflicts, Microsoft returned the law firm to its list of preferred firms. The Latham agreement created concerns about potential conflicts of interest issues that could have affected the firm's ability to represent Microsoft. Microsoft's Palmer said in a written statement, "Latham's leaders," he said, "provided the strong assurances we needed to address our concerns." The law firms named in this article declined to publicly discuss client matters. Leaders of firms that struck deals said their business have continued to thrive and that they have received calls from clients supportive of the deals. They have said that the agreements won't force them to take on pro bono work that would create conflicts with existing clients. The firms that chose to sue over executive orders said in court filings that they have fielded calls from anxious clients that lost business because of the orders. Judges have struck down the orders against Wilmer Hale, Jennings and Block, and Perkins Coie, and the order against Sussman Godfrey has been temporarily blocked. Judges have said the executive orders amounted to unconstitutional retaliation against the firms. On a website touting the firm's lawsuit, Jenner and Block said relenting to the White House would mean compromising our ability to zealously advocate for all of our clients and capitulating to unconstitutional government coercion which is simply not in our DNA. Some general counsels said they are giving new work to the resisting firms in show of solidarity. Internal strife. At Caldwater, Wickersham, and Taft, managing partner Pat Quinn grew emotional when he announced to fellow partners that their firm, the oldest in New York, had reached a deal for peace with the Trump administration. Days later, in a firm-wide meeting, Quinn said Caldwater's leadership had strongly considered fighting the Trump administration, but ultimately elected to reach a deal out of a sense of duty to the firm and its clients, according to people familiar with his remarks. Emotions have run high inside some firms that struck deals, particularly among young lawyers. At Skadden, Simpson, Latham, and Kirkland, some associates have quit over the deals. One associate leaving Simpson wrote in his departure email, shared on LinkedIn, that he refused to sleepwalk toward authoritarianism. Partners, too, have left some of the firms that have made deals. At Sullivan and Cromwell, some lawyers have bristled at the role that co-chair Robert Giaffra played in facilitating a deal for Trump to drop an executive order against rival firm Paul Weiss. Giaffra, one of Trump's personal lawyers, participated by phone in an Oval Office discussion with the Paul Weiss leader, who was there to work out a deal. Giaffra is representing Trump in two New York appeals, one of them a challenge to his conviction in the Stormy Daniels hush money case. Giaffra told his partners that taking on the cases would give the firm strong ties to the new administration. Trying to quell discontent within his own firm, Giaffra told partners at an April meeting that he believed the orders were likely unconstitutional and would be blocked by judges, and that he hoped the White House would stop issuing them, according to people familiar with his remarks. White House aides said they weren't aware of his opposition. Trump remains interested in the orders, and Deputy White House Chief of Staff Stephen Miller and his allies want to keep the threats of more executive orders on the table because they think it dissuades the best lawyers from representing critics of the administration. Miller has repeatedly complained that some of the country's top lawyers took on lawsuits against the Trump administration in the first term, which he and other Trump advisors view as stymieing the agenda of a democratically elected president. The White House's appetite for a fight with the legal industry appears to have waned. There hasn't been a new executive order since early April. And on to our next story in pharma. Novartis's cancer treatment, Pluvicto, shows positive results in trial. The treatment showed statistically significant and clinically meaningful benefits, it said. By Nina Canley. Novartis said Pluvicto demonstrated positive results in patients with PSMA-positive metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. The Swiss pharmaceutical company on Monday said Pluvicto showed statistically significant and clinically meaningful benefits, including combined with hormone therapy versus hormone therapy alone, with positive trend in overall survival. The results are from pre-specified interim analysis of a phase 3 trial, it said. Pluvicto is already approved for metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer and now shows potential in patients in an earlier disease setting, it said. The company will present results at an upcoming medical meeting and, based on FDA feedback, will submit for a regulatory review in the second half of the year, it said. Pluvicto is a radioactive medication used to treat certain types of prostate cancer. Currencies. Dollar likely to weaken further on fading U.S. exceptionalism, other factors. The dollar is likely to weaken further as fading U.S. exceptionalism is ongoing and is expected to persist through second half, Nomura's research analysts say in a research report. Other factors include implications of U.S. fiscal and current account worries, asset reallocation, and FX hedging, and uncertainty from President Trump's tariff and non-tariff policies, the analysts say. The combination of trade deals and Asia that could encompass appreciation of undervalued currencies, potential repatriation of foreign investment, and FX hedging support are higher conviction views of short USD KRW, the analysts say. KRW could appreciate significantly toward 1,300 in the coming months, they add. USD, KRW is 0.5% lower at 1,375.73. And on to our next story. China hits back against Trump claims that it broke trade truce as tensions simmer. Recent developments have damped optimism that the two superpowers will reach a lasting deal. By Tracy Q. China has pushed back against President Trump's accusation that it broke a trade truce reached just weeks earlier as a re-escalation of tensions dim hopes of a resolution. Beijing has acted responsibly and upheld the consensus reached at the economic and trade talks in Geneva, the Commerce Ministry said in a statement on its website Monday. Washington and Beijing agreed in mid-May to temporarily lower tit-for-tat tariffs after talks in Geneva, sending a wave of relief across global markets that have been hammered by fears of a trade war since Trump took office and started raising tariffs on China and other countries. Recent developments have damped optimism that the two superpowers will reach a lasting deal, with tensions flaring up over issues such as China's exports of rare earth minerals and the Trump administration's crackdowns on student visas. On Monday, the Chinese Commerce Ministry said it is the U.S. side that has seriously undermined the consensus reached in Geneva. It alleged that Washington introduced multiple discriminatory and restrictive measures against China, such as issuing export control guidelines for artificial intelligence chips and revoking visas for Chinese students. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. The Commerce Ministry's statement came after Trump said in a social media post on Friday that China has totally violated its agreement with the U.S. He repeated the accusation later on, telling reporters at the Oval Office that he was certain he would speak to Chinese leader Xi Jinping about the matter. "They violated a big part of the agreement we made," Trump said. "I'm sure that I'll speak to President Xi. Hopefully we'll work that out. It's a violation of the agreement." He didn't provide details. The latest signs of a breakdown in progress toward a deal soured the mood in markets, with Chinese companies falling again in Hong Kong on Monday. That followed declines on Friday after comments from U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent describing U.S.-China talks as a bit stalled. The benchmark Hang Seng Index led declines in holiday-thinned Asia trading, falling 2.2% by midday. The Hang Seng Tech Index was down 2.2%. Chinese state-owned steel manufacturers added to the downward pressure, reacting to Trump's threat to double tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. Business. Rio Tinto agrees to new management plan in area where it destroyed ancient caves. The company has agreed to a new management plan with a local indigenous group. By David Winning. Sydney. Rio Tinto has agreed to a new management plan with a local indigenous group that covers its iron ore operations in an area of Australia's Pilbara region where it destroyed two ancient rock shelters 5 years ago. The destruction of the Juukan rock shelters in 2020 led to the departure of several senior Rio Tinto executives, including then-CEO Jean-Sébastien Jacques. It showed how environmental and cultural issues have taken center stage in an industry that is fighting to change investors' perceptions that mining is problematic. Rio Tinto said its new agreement with the Puutu Kunti Kumara and Pinikura Aboriginal Corp formalizes how they will engage on proposals affecting heritage and how culturally significant places can be preserved when mining is happening nearby. "Our actions were wrong," Simon Trott, chief executive of Rio Tinto's iron ore business, said of the destruction of the Juukan shelters. We've failed to uphold our company's values, and our systems and processes were inadequate. Simply put, it should never have happened, and for that we will forever be sorry. The PKKP, Aboriginal Corporation, said the new agreement means both parties would work together earlier, even when exploration for metals and minerals hasn't yet begun. Jordan Ralph, the PKKP Aboriginal Corps' chief heritage officer, said that mining companies would previously only step up engagement with Indigenous groups after they had already spent lots of money in studying prospective land. Changing their plan at that point, once they've already told the market their mineable resource and have already spent enormous amounts of money on these plans, is a very difficult thing for a mining company to do, financially speaking, he said. What we've done here is remove that situation from the equation. Grant Wilson, chief executive of PKKP Aboriginal Corporation, said the PKKP community has made it clear that it isn't against mining, but that it has to be undertaken in a culturally sensitive way. Europe. Poland elects conservative with ties to Trump as president. Karol Nawrocki, supported by Law and Justice Party, has worked to make inroads with right-wing voters, by Thomas Grove and Karolina Janatz, a conservative historian who had flaunted his ties with President Trump, won Poland's presidential election Sunday in a close, high-pressure race that drew the largest turnout since the country shook off communism in 1989. Karol Nawrocki, 42, who is supported by the conservative Law and Justice Party, won 50.89% of the vote. Warsaw Mayor Rafael Trzaskowski received 49.11%. Nawrocki has run the state's Institute for National Remembrance, an organization meant to document historical crimes committed against Poland by the Nazis and communists. He has borrowed policy promises from far-right parties during the race and promised to block a Ukrainian accession to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The White House released pictures last month of Nawrocki's meeting with Trump in the Oval Office. Nawrocki also drew a show of support at last week's first Poland meeting of the Conservative Political Action Committee, a U.S.-based conservative advocacy group that has expanded into Europe. U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who attended the conference, started her speech by saying Nawrocki needs to be the next president of Poland. With high levels of support for the U.S. and Poland, many Poles also believe a good relationship with Washington will maintain a strong bilateral ties and keep America's security blanket extended to Poland on the border with Ukraine. Nawrocki does well to show himself as close to Trump because Polish society is predominantly sympathetic toward the U.S. no matter who is in charge, said Sledomir Debski, a professor of strategy and international relations at the Warsaw-based College of Europe in Natalin. If elected, Nawrocki would have direct access to Trump's administration. Trzaskowski, on the other hand, had vowed to work with other European leaders to make Poland, which has the third largest military in NATO, central to the continent's defense architecture. While largely a ceremonial role, the president is able to veto legislation or recommend it to the Constitutional Court. Current President Andrzej Duda, who is also a backer of the Law and Justice Party, has done both, stymieing the current ruling center-left coalition, which ousted the party in 2023 elections. That dynamic is expected to stay in place with the victory of Nawrocki, who will likely continue hampering Prime Minister Donald Tusk's efforts to enact more reformist legislation meant to roll back some of the landmark laws passed by Law and Justice in their 8 years in power, which restricted access to abortion and which critics say politicized the judiciary. Policy. Trump looks to shore up support for GOP mega bill. Republican concerns about the bill and trade tensions with China are expected to dominate White House agenda this week. by Alex Leary, Richard Rubin, and Michael R. Gordon. President Trump plans to push lawmakers on his tax and spending megabill this week in an effort to overcome Republican concerns about deficit spending. As the White House also seeks to get trade talks with China back on track, Trump plans to have a call with Chinese leader Xi Jinping this week in hopes of easing tensions that have risen in recent days, administration officials said. The economic focus sets up a big week for Trump and his overall agenda, which has been mired in a growing number of court and other battles. Last week, the Trump administration appealed a significant ruling striking down global tariffs. Separately, Trump accused Beijing of violating the terms of an agreement reached earlier in May. Trump is expected to amplify calls for Republican unity around what the party has branded the Big Beautiful Bill and speak with Senate Majority Leader John Thune, R. South Dakota, about the next steps as lawmakers return from recess, a senior official said Sunday. But Thune, like his counterpart in the House, has a narrow majority, and a number of GOP senators have expressed concerns that could derail a July 4th target of getting the bill to Trump's desk. Over the weekend, Trump took aim at one of the concerned lawmakers, Senator Rand Paul, R. Kentucky, who says the bill will explode the debt. If Paul votes against our great big beautiful bill, he is voting for, along with the radical left Democrats, Trump said on social media Saturday. Rand will be playing right into the hands of the Democrats, and the great people of Kentucky will never forgive him. Paul didn't back down, saying Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation that the math doesn't really add up and that there is too much spending. Paul said he thinks there are four Senate Republicans who would oppose the bill as currently written, enough to kill the legislation, as it isn't expected to gain Democratic support. The bill passed the House on May 22nd after an all-night session, following an occasionally rocky process that foreshadowed difficulties in the Senate. Some senators are considering further spending cuts, while others are looking for better, more permanent tax relief or general, gentler phase-outs of clean energy incentives. Hard-fought House sweeteners such as the higher cap on state and local tax deductions could face scrutiny in the Senate, where high-tax states such as New York, New Jersey, and California don't have any Republican members. So could House changes that reduce projected Medicaid spending and are forecast to lower the number of people with health insurance. Any changes by GOP senators would then have to be approved by the House before heading to Trump's desk, and House lawmakers have counseled them to keep alterations to a minimum. Trump has said he expects changes. The House-passed measure is expected to increase projected budget deficits by some $2.7 trillion over a decade, compared with doing nothing and letting tax cuts expire. The publicity-held federal debt is approaching 100% of gross domestic product and is already poised to exceed its post-World War II high. House Speaker Mike Johnson, R. Louisiana, defended that legislation Sunday and discounted expert analysis of the bill's effects, saying those don't take into account the growth that tax cuts and other parts of the Trump agenda would spur. "I am telling you this is going to reduce the deficit," Johnson said on NBC's Meet the Press, adding he was confident the bill could still reach Trump's desk by July 4. For Paul, the largest obstacle is a provision in the bill to raise the debt ceiling. The House version raises that by $4 trillion, while the Senate would push it to $5 trillion. If that provision is removed, Paul said on CBS, "In all likelihood, I can vote for what the agreement is on the rest of the bill, and it doesn't have to be perfect to my liking." If the debt ceiling is stripped from the broader bill, Congress would need to move quickly to pass a separate measure raising the limit, and that would likely require Democratic votes. Paul isn't alone in his objections. Senator Ron Johnson, R. Wisconsin, reiterated Sunday that the Senate needed to cut deeper than the House bill to win his support, and Senators Mike Lee, R. Utah, and Rick Scott, our Florida, have also pushed for more reductions. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has said that the government could reach the end of its borrowing authority by August. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Now continuing on with our story. If the debt limit isn't raised, he said Sunday on CBS that the U.S. is never going to default, adding, "We are on the warning track and we will never hit the wall." J.P. Morgan Chase Chief Executive Jamie Dimon warned Friday that the bond market could buckle if the U.S. doesn't contain the national debt. Asked about that, Bessent said, "I've known Jamie a long time, and for his entire career he's made predictions like this. Fortunately, none of them have come true." He added of the debt, "We didn't get here in 1 year, and this has been a long process. So the goal is to bring it down over the next 4 years." Bessent predicted Trump could soon talk with Xi, as trade talks have turned sour in recent days. Trump has accused China of not honoring terms of a détente that was reached last month in Geneva. In particular, the dispute concerns what the U.S. says is slow-walking rare earth exports. The White House has fielded complaints from many companies, in particular automakers, about export license delays. "I am confident that when President Trump and Party Chairman Xi have a call, that this will be ironed out," Bessent said Sunday. "I believe we'll see something very soon." Business. How much should the world's richest man get paid? Tesla must decide how to pay Elon Musk, who has demanded a bigger stake and whose last package has been thrown out, by Theo Francis. Elon Musk was the lowest paid chief executive of an S&P 500 company last year. It has been that way for several years amid a legal battle over a monster stock award in 2018. A court has twice thrown out Musk's pay package, calling the process of creating it flawed despite two votes of support from shareholders. Now Tesla's business is struggling. Musk is fresh off his detour through U.S. politics, and the Tesla board is exploring a new compensation package for its longtime leader. It must answer a thorny question: How do you pay the world's richest man? Pay for a founder CEO varies widely. Taser maker Axon gave Rick Smith a $165 million stock award last year, making him the highest paid CEO in the Wall Street Journal's annual ranking. Meta paid Mark Zuckerberg, its billionaire co-founder, $27 million last year, mostly for personal security services. Michael Dell got $3.1 million, mostly cash, while Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett famously collects a modest salary and security benefits, $405,100, and gets no stock grants. Even for individuals in lofty positions, pay can vary wildly. President Trump makes $400,000 a year, plus $50,000 tax-free expense allowance. The president of Harvard gets more than $1 million. Baseball's Juan Soto could make as much as $800 million over 15 years under his late 2024 contract with the New York Mets. Tesla didn't respond to requests for comments. Here are three approaches to paying Musk. Option one, make him show up and go big. Tesla's board should make it clear to Musk that he has to show up and do the job and be serious about planning for an eventual replacement, said Alan Johnson, managing director of Johnson Associates, a pay consulting firm. That could mean he has less time to spend on SpaceX, government work, and his other ventures. Why should Tesla have to pay for that? It's making some requirements about him being involved, having some succession, and starting to run it like a real company, Johnson said. If you stay and create value, you'll make an awful lot of money, but if you don't want to be involved or you don't create value, you won't. That done, the board should think big. Musk is clearly motivated by the potential to reap billions of dollars in Tesla shares, Johnson added. There's no point in putting out millions of dollars for him when that would be irrelevant, Johnson said. It would be a lot of billions. Tesla should also keep the structure of must pay simpler, Johnson said. His 2018 options grant was too intricate, with a dozen tranches, and even more discrete market and operating targets. This time, he recommends eliminating the complexity and paying for stock price performance that beats the market or even matches it, given that Tesla may no longer be the red-hot growth engine it once was. The value today is enormous, and I think that has got to be recognized. So maintaining or growing it relative to the market would be worth an awful lot of money, Johnson said. It's about value creation. It's not about how many cars you're going to sell. Option two, pay him like a CEO. Others argue it isn't the board's job to satisfy must demands for a bigger ownership stake in the automaker. The CEO has openly discussed devoting his attention elsewhere if he can't own a quarter of Tesla. He controls about 20% now. Musk said he would give him a freer hand. You're paying the person to do an executive job, and you have to separate that from what kind of equity stake they have, said Robin Ferracone, founder and CEO of pay consultancy Ferriant Advisors. If he wants a bigger stake in the company, go buy it. The board could establish a co-investment arrangement under which Tesla matches some level of shares Musk acquires if he stays for several years, Ferracone said. Investors like that better than just giving away restricted stock, for example. Ferracone wasn't a fan of the size of Musk's 2018 option grant, but said its design had merit, rewarding him for incremental stock price appreciation if it was accompanied by financial gains. Most in the pay industry argue Tesla's board should follow the same process boards should to set pay for any other CEO. Identify a constellation of broadly similar executives, including founders of big tech companies and CEOs at automakers and artificial intelligence companies, for example, and use those to establish a dollar amount that makes sense. The decision-making process for a compensation committee, in our opinion, should not be different for founder pay and non-founder pay, said Scott Oberstadt, senior director for executive compensation at Willis Towers Watson, speaking generally. Option three, pay him like everyone else. The top-paid CEO of 2024, Axon Smith, said his own $165 million pay package last year was structured under a plan open to the company's roughly 4,000 employees. He describes it as an outgrowth of its prior pay package, which in turn was inspired by Musk's 2018 grant. The 2024 package is tied to a series of targets, combining share price and financial measures, with restrictions preventing shares from vesting too quickly. Axon employees can forego a chunk of income over 7 years, using it to bet on the company's performance. Those making less than $90,000 a year receive grants outright. I'm on the same mathematical plan as everyone else, Smith said. I would love to see other companies copy that. If Axon matches typical S&P 500 growth, the CEO and other employees get shares initially valued at about what they set aside, Smith said. Stronger performance could triple their shares. Lagging performance means less and potentially nothing. So far, Smith calls it a success, in part because it gives Axon a way to compete with startups offering shares and the potential for big stock gains. Most who could took a large chunk of pay and deferred, Smith said. We are seeing the benefits of everyone being aligned to the same metrics. Healthcare, inside the spectacular downfall of United Healthcare and its CEO, Andrew Witty, who largely led the U.S. healthcare giant from the U.K., made big bets on Medicare enrollees that backfired. By Anna Wild Matthews and Christopher Weaver. On February 5th, top executives of United Healthcare Group gathered in a conference center on the company's suburban Minneapolis campus. Chief Executive Officer Andrew Witty stood up in the front and offered an encouraging message. Business was good. He was optimistic about the company's prospects in the coming year. A trio of other executives extolled the recent insurance season when people start their new coverage, including a large number of Medicare enrollees. They were happy with how smoothly things were going. 2 months later, those same Medicare patients would be at the center of a financial meltdown that has wiped out more than $250 billion in market capitalization at the healthcare giant. On April 17th, Witte announced disappointing profits and cut UnitedHealthcare's earnings projections for the rest of 2025. Weeks later, the company withdrew its financial guidance altogether, saying costs were accelerating. With that, Witte was out, replaced by UnitedHealthcare's chairman and former longtime chief, Stephen Hemsley. Today, UnitedHealthcare's shares are worth about half of their value before the April announcement. It is a plunge that has left investors asking how UnitedHealth, a company with earnings and shares that rose steadily for decades, could have reversed fortunes so rapidly. Aggressive business practices left the company vulnerable to regulatory change and scrutiny, including three investigations from the Justice Department. Higher costs for Medicare patients slammed a key sector. And Witte, a British executive whose background wasn't in the U.S. insurance industry, didn't delve deeply into operational details, striking an optimistic tone with investors and employees, even as problems stacked up. According to interviews with current and former employees, industry officials, and analysts, and internal documents viewed by the Wall Street Journal. A company spokesman said Hemsley would share more details about the company's performance and plans during its shareholder meeting on Monday. He said Witte's departure was for personal reasons and that he led UnitedHealth Group with compassion and dignity through some of the most challenging times any company has ever faced. He said Witte, who is now a company advisor, wasn't available for comment. Witte, who was earlier CEO of the drug maker GlaxoSmithKline, now known as GSK, took over UnitedHealth in 2021. The sprawling company is parent of the largest health insurer in the country, UnitedHealthcare, as well as a health services arm, Optum, which includes doctor groups, a pharmacy benefits manager, and other assets. From the start, he presided over the Minnesota-based healthcare giant while living across the Atlantic in Buckinghamshire, outside London, according to property records and UnitedHealth's proxy documents. The proxy said the company helped with his taxes because he lived in the UK. When he was in the US, he generally worked out of a UnitedHealth office in Washington, D.C., where he has an apartment. For meetings such as the February gathering, which happened quarterly, he typically flew in using a corporate Gulfstream jet. The jet also went back and forth to London. Would he never moved into the window-lined CEO office at the Minnesota headquarters, once occupied by Hemsley, which was given to a local executive, operating chief Dirk McMahon. Monthly executive meetings, which had been in person under Hemsley and were so intense some executive called them colonoscopies, were often presided over virtually under Witte, according to former executives. He generally left the detailed grilling to McMahon, who retired in April 2024. The UnitedHealth spokesman said that when Witte was in the U.S., he split time between Minnesota and Washington, and that he had offices in both places and an apartment in Minnesota. In 2024, the company had began saying in its financial filings that it had headquarters in both places. As CEO, Witte brought a different style to a company that has been led for 15 years by accountants who wore suits to work. He sported zippered tracksuit style tops and a signature collection of brightly colored sneakers. Witte enhanced some educational and child care benefits and changed some of UnitedHealth's hiring practices to add to the workforce's diversity. Some of his top hires were former colleagues from GSK who hadn't spent their careers in the U.S. insurance or healthcare provider industries. Roger Connor, a longtime pharmaceutical executive, was put in charge of Optum Insight, the technology and data unit. Starting in 2022, UnitedHealth's general counsel was Rupert Bondy, a British attorney who had worked at GlaxoSmithKline and BP, but not in the heavily regulated U.S. insurance sector. Under Witte, UnitedHealth grew in ways that brought outsized profits, but also exposed it to greater downside when costs rose and Medicare payment rules changed. The company is dominant in Medicare Advantage, the business of privately managed Medicare plans, in which enrollment continued to grow. and Woody scaled up the role of its Optum doctor practices. With UnitedHealthcare getting taxpayer-funded payments to cover Medicare patients, while also using a share of the premiums to pay its Optum doctors to treat them, Medicare was a booming business for UnitedHealth. The company was reaping profits on both the doctor and insurance sides. UnitedHealth's total margins on Medicare enrollees could be double what traditional Medicare insurers made, former employees said, partly because federal rules limit how much premium revenues healthcare insurers can retain, constraining the margins for pure insurance companies. In addition, the government pays Medicare insurers more for sicker patients with certain diagnoses, and UnitedHealth gathered those lucrative diagnoses for Medicare customers at high rates, a journal investigation showed last year. At the start of 2025, Woody set a typically optimistic tone after a difficult year that included both a devastating hack of technology unit and the killing of the leader of UnitedHealthcare. Woody told analysts in January that the company always found a way to deliver on its commitments and were invigorated by the path ahead, but the roots of the financial downfall were already growing. The Medicare agency in 2023 made big changes to the system that had worked so well for UnitedHealth, eliminating those lucrative payments for many diagnoses. The new phased-in rules first affected payments in 2024. UnitedHealth had long known the Medicare payment changes would be challenging. An internal Optum analysis of around 900,000 patients from the end of 2023, viewed by the journal, projected that the new billing rules would cut back sharply on the diagnoses of chronic health conditions that led to the higher payments. UnitedHealth also bet on Medicare growth for 2025, including in plans that target high-risk patients, even as competitors were retrenching after high costs across the industry in 2024 hurt profits and share prices. On April 17th, disclosing the earnings miss, Woody spoke with far less of his trademark ebullience. He called the results frankly unusual and unacceptable. The company was seeing higher-than-expected costs for its Medicare plan enrollees, among other issues. Because of UnitedHealth's model, profits were squeezed in both its insurance unit and its Optum doctor groups. The margins had shrunk, and they can't double-dip in both the insurance and doctor businesses, said John Ransom, an analyst with Raymond James. Woody also acknowledged that UnitedHealth was struggling with the new Medicare payment system. In the weeks following the April earnings announcement, Hemsley was in the Minnesota offices nearly every day, meeting with executives, asking questions, and delving into the company's issues, according to people familiar with the matter. Woody told people he was considering his alternatives, including whether he should step down, a person familiar with the matter said. The board met in early May, and Woody's departure was announced May 13. Hemsley is working around the clock, asking tough questions, and meeting leaders and colleagues across the enterprise, the UnitedHealth spokesman said. And on to our next article. Russia. Ukraine says it destroyed dozens of warplanes deep inside Russia. Clandestine drone attacks, 18 months in planning, deals biggest blow of the war against Moscow's long-range bomber fleet, by Jane Ledovenko. Ukraine launched audacious drone attacks on four military airports inside Russia, destroying more than 40 warplanes in the biggest blow of the war against Moscow's long-range bomber fleet. The attack, dubbed Spider's Web, took a year and a half to prepare, officials at Ukraine's main security and intelligence agency, the SBU, said on Sunday. Ukraine's drones targeted Russia's Belaya, Ivano, Devlago, and Olenya air bases, all of which house Russia's military planes. The bombardment is a significant victory for Ukraine's deep strike program, which uses drones to target crucial material on Russia's soil. Ukraine's intelligence agency has used sea drones and long-range bombing drones to strike inside Russia. Videos of the attack taken by drones show smoke emanating from planes at Balaya Airfield near Russia's border with Mongolia, according to footage shared by Ukrainian intelligence officials. "This is how nice the Balaya Airfield looks now," Lieutenant Vasil Maluk, head of Ukraine's intelligence agency, said in the video. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a video address that the absolute unique operation involved 117 drones. The base of the operation was located near an office of Russia's Federal Security Service, Zelensky said. "We will defend ourselves with all available methods," Zelensky said. Ukrainian intelligence officials said the agency moved the small quadcopter drones to Russian territory. It then moved wooden containers to Russia, which were used to hide the drones ahead of the attack. When it came time to strike, the containers were placed on trucks and the lids of the containers were opened remotely. The swarms of drones flew out to find their targets. In a video posted to social media, the drones appeared to take off out of a container with a buzzing sound. Shots rang out in an apparent attempt to down it. Another drone flew out of the container in the same direction. In another video, an explosion strikes as the plane parked at an airport. "This is not yet a knockout, but quite a serious knockdown for the enemy," said Irina Vereshchuk, a top official in Zelensky's office. "This is exactly what wars the future will look like." Ukraine didn't provide advance notice to the Trump administration of its drone strikes against Russia's air bases, a senior U.S. official said. Russia's defense ministry called the operation a terrorist attack. The scope of the damage would take time to assess, but it appeared to be a significant blow to Russia's long-range aviation capacity, said Justin Bronk, a senior research fellow at the Royal United States Institute, Royal United Services Institute in London. "Ukrainian special services have struck by far the heaviest blow of the war against the Russian long-range aviation bomber fleet," Bronk said. While the operation was a boost to Ukraine, the front line remains hotly contested as Russia embarks on another summer offensive, focusing its forces in the southeast and along the border region of Sumy, but not achieving a major breakthrough. Russian and Ukrainian delegations are set to meet on Monday in Istanbul for negotiations aimed at ending the war. Zelensky said Ukrainians are demanding a full ceasefire, the release of prisoners, and the return of the children Russia abducted. "Russia hasn't sent its proposals ahead of the talks," Ukrainian officials said. While previous talks made little progress to halt fighting, the two sides agreed to a large prisoner swap. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke Sunday with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and reiterated President Trump's call for continued direct talks between Russia and Ukraine. "Losing dozens of long-range aircraft vital to Russia's nuclear forces and its attack on Ukraine would gravely damage Russian military strength. Russia no longer produces the 295MS or 222M3 planes that were among those damaged, according to Ukrainian intelligence officials. Russia, before the attacks, had 54 222M3S and 58 295Ms, according to the Military Balance Plus, a database produced at the International Institute of Strategic Studies, a London think tank. It isn't clear how many of those planes were operational. In Russia, old planes have long been kept and cannibalized for spare parts. The 295, which first flew in the 1950s, is powered by propellers, not jet engines. Crippling the planes lessens Russia's ability to carry out the combined airstrikes it has used to overwhelm Ukrainian air defenses with drones while launching difficult-to-intercept missiles, said George Barros, an analyst at the Institutes for the Study of War. "By killing the archers instead of intercepting the arrows, it's a more effective way to degrade Russian capabilities," Barros said. Middle East, more than 20 Gazans killed trying to get aid, Palestinian authorities say. Shooting is the deadliest incident since Israeli-backed aid distribution plan started last week by Anat Pillid, Suaid Maid, and Abir Ayyob. More than 20 Gazans were killed as they made their way to a U.S.-Israeli aid distribution center. Palestinian health authorities say the latest violence in a chaotic rollout of a new assistance program. Crowds of hungry Gazans making their way to an aid distribution center in southern Gaza on Sunday morning were fired on by what appeared to be Israeli forces, said witnesses who spoke to the Wall Street Journal. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said it evacuated 23 dead and 23 injured people from the area. An Israeli military official said troops fired warning shots toward crowds that approached them around a kilometer from the distribution center in Rafah. It said no shooting had taken place at the distribution site. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which oversees the new aid system, said no shooting took place at its distribution centers or in their immediate vicinity. The shooting is the deadliest incident since the start of a new Israeli-backed aid distribution system last week in Gaza. The system aims to bypass United Nations groups, which previously distributed the aid, and Hamas, which Israel accuses of taking control of aid. The U.S.-designated terrorist group denies seizing aid. On Tuesday, Israeli troops fired warning shots at crowds who broke into a distribution center. Under the new system, aid is distributed to Gazans by a private U.S. security company. Israeli troops are stationed nearby. With aid supplies limited and only one of four planned distribution centers operating over the past few days, many Gazans have awakened before dawn to reach the center before limited supplies ran out. Abdullah Joed, 24, said he left his tent in Al-Mawasi at 3 a.m. By the time he arrived at the Al-Alam roundabout after 4 a.m., he could hear shooting in all directions. People started shouting, "Go back, go back. There are so many dead ahead," Jodea said, adding that he saw three people lying dead on the ground. "Every 2 minutes, we had to drop to the ground because of the bullets." Israel recently ended a more than two-month blockade on Gaza, during which no aid, medicine, or fuel entered the enclave, leading to widespread hunger, according to residents and aid groups. The U.S., Israel's close ally, pushed Israel to lift the blockade. But little aid has since reached Gazans, and many are surviving on just one meal a day. Some Gazans continue to rush toward the distribution center despite seeing people near them being shot. "I saw people hit in the head, others shot in the legs," said Issa Abu Abdua, 45, who is sheltering in Al-Mawasi. "He pressed forward," he said. By the time he reached the distribution square, he found nothing but empty boxes. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.